WPFW, Washington. Live from Ben's Next Door, 12th and U Streets Northwest, it's the Raucous Caucus with Garland Nixon, Mark Levine, and Terry D. Kester. It's seriously funny, and it begins right now.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Raucous Caucus. My name's Garland Nixon and I'm here with
Terry D. Kester
and Mark Levine.
And we have a special guest today, and you know, I've been messing his name up here for the last several weeks, but I'm going to try Dr. Bernard Demchuk.
That's good. That sounds good.
Yeah, and
yeah, you were calling him Dump Truck earlier, Garland, yeah, which I don't think he appreciated.
Yeah, well, I'm still back to metal floors.
You can call me Dump Truck, just don't call me late for dinner. Ha ha ha.
Right.
Yeah, leave the jokes to us. Yeah,
speaking of dinner, where the heck are we?
And we'll leave the metal floors to Terry. We don't use metal floors here.
Where are we? Yeah.
But speaking of that,
Ben's Next Door.
We are
Ben's Chili Bowl.
Yep, we're at Ben's Next Door, 1211 U Street. We are right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. We're in the back upstairs. Live audience, live show. Come on up. We got drinks. We got food. We got lots of good, fun things happening. Come on down, hang out, be part of conversation.
This is your last chance for the month because July's ending. So you have to come see us tonight or you have to wait till September.
That's right. All of August, we will be in studio. But that means you can call in you can be a part of the Raucous Caucus and you can voice your opinions and jump right in.
But we don't go that far.
We can give them their opinions and they can actually reflect ours back.
Exactly. That's good. That works for me. But if you want to see us in the flesh,
and try to
break up fights among us, please come down right now. You got a whole hour to do it. To Ben's Next Door, come up in the back.
Do you want to clarify what in the flesh means?
We don't want that to happen, Mark.
No, thank you.
I'm a little worried, Mark.
So, tonight, we have a great show. Come on down here, Ben's Next Door, 1211 U Street, next to Ben's Chili Bowl. We've got a great show, and we are going to talk about an interesting subject that you'll want to be a part of, the legacy of slavery. Slavery was, you know, many, many years ago, but clearly...
No, it wasn't. It was just yesterday.
Yeah. Well, you know,
we had slavery in America?
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
That sounds awful. Slavery was many, many years ago, relevant to the normal 70 years of human existence.
We just have slave wages.
But
today,
relevant to the age of the earth, I guess it's kind of like one sheet of toilet paper on a big roll.
That's a bad
you know,
metaphor,
that's how,
but we
that's how far
you
away it was.
You and your metal floors.
Yes, me and my metal floors. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to start with Bernie here. We will forego the Dr. Demchuk from now on, and we'll just call him Bernie.
It's a lot easier to pronounce.
We want you to lay out the legacy of slavery for us, briefly kind of lay it out, and then we can discuss
why don't you tell everyone what he's a doctor of, though, because that's important.
Yes.
He is a doctor. He worked hard to get that doctorate.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background, and then lay it out for us.
Well, thank you, and it's great to be here with the Raucous Caucus. I see why you guys are raucous.
Good.
We've just gotten started, Doctor.
I can see that you are a caucus, and I'm not going to try the jokes. I'm going to leave it to you guys.
That's safe.
Cheap humor. It's not really jokes.
We're not very good at it either. Yeah. So
this is the shotgun approach. We throw a lot of them out, and every now and then we get a fun one.
That's right.
But I live three blocks away from here in historic African-American Shaw. I was a very active participant in the civil rights movement as a youth, and I eventually came to work with Marion Barry and Jesse Jackson. I spent my 30 years with Marion Barry and Jesse Jackson doing African-American empowerment, political empowerment, and I have a PhD from the George Washington University in African-American history and culture. My specialties are slavery, D.C. black history, and classic black cinema.
Wow, that's awesome stuff.
That's a good resume. I like that.
Yeah. So lay out what you would consider the legacy of slavery. What do we have left over today as a result of slavery? And we can get this discussion going. Once again, we're at Ben's Next Door. You want to be here to hear this show.
1211 U Street.
This 1211 U Street. You know, this is a highly serious topic. And that is not to dampen any of the energy that's coming out of this raucous caucus this evening, but this is a very serious topic, and it's a very serious, sobering discussion to have. allow me to first, before I start, to say this is really relevant today, Garland, Terry, and Mark, because we just learned very, very possibly that the first black president of the United States of America may in fact be a direct descendant of the first African slave in America, a gentleman by the name of John Punch.
You're kidding.
No, I am not kidding. It has been all over CNN this morning. It was in the Washington Post and it was in the New York Times. If it's in the two papers of record and on CNN, then it has to have some validity. Indeed, they do. But allow me to just give a very brief explanation of what this means. Starting in 1619, the first Africans brought into North America were not, in fact, slaves as we know them today. They were indentured servants. And the indentured servants of blacks, Irish, Scotch, and the Native Americans, that continued all the way up to the 1670s. John Punch, named Punch, P-U-N-C-H, was an indentured servant in 1841 when he was supposed to indenture for only 5 years, but his master kept him for two more years. So therefore, rather than 5 years, he was going to go for 7 years, so he ran away.
That's how slavery began in America?
He ran away with two other gentlemen. They were white, and they were Irishmen. They got caught. They were brought back. When they were brought back to their master, the two white men got an additional 5 years of indenture, and John Punch got life as an indentured servant, which means slavery.
So you're saying prior to 1670, there were no formal slaves as such?
There were. The colony of Virginia began to move into this issue of slavery because white indentures in England and Scotland and in Ireland were beginning to dry up because the economic conditions were getting better over there. Therefore, they were not going to risk their life and limb by coming all the way across the ocean to get a job. So as they began to dry up and they needed more and more labor to produce more and more wealth, which means planting tobacco and harvesting tobacco, as they needed more labor, they turned to Africans. And as they turned to Africans and Africans became more rebellious and Africans became obviously different because of the color of their skin, it was easier to enslave Africans than it was the Irish or the Scots or the Indians. Consequently, there was a big rebellion in Virginia in 1676 called Bacon's Rebellion. Bacon's Rebellion was a combination of Irish, Indian, Native and Black Americans, Black Africans, and Scots, and they rebelled against the Governor Bradford of Virginia. As a result of that rebellion, the only ones that they could truly identify that were part of the rebellion were
the
Africans.
And starting, I would think they could identify the Native Americans too, no?
Well, they could, but the Native Americans were very skilled at running away and going where?
Well,
they, the bush.
They knew the area. They'd lived there a long time.
They knew the area. They knew the back alleys.
Right.
And they could get away. In fact, they would blend into their own culture. But consequently, the African could not. So we begin to get slavery starting in the late 1660s and 70s, and Virginia becomes the first state, the first colony, to actually legalize racialized slavery in 1660.
Now, this is really
interesting. Wasn't England practicing slavery by this time?
Sure. They were practicing slavery where? In the Caribbean.
Yeah.
They were practicing slavery
in the
Brazil,
but,
in the Dominican.
But as British citizens, which is, of course, what we were, I mean, it's just a really natural
But not in the North American colony of Virginia. In the North American colony of Virginia, there was an opportunity by John Punch, and I can list a dozen other Africans who had their freedom at that time. And as a matter of fact, John Punch had a relationship with a white woman. And that white woman we have now found today, read your newspaper, we found today is a direct descendant of Barack Obama's white mother from Kansas.
Ascendant.
Really?
Ancestor.
And descendant.
Yeah.
Well, how
direct
is that?
About
that kind
14,
of freaks me out, if you're knowing the truth.
So not only do we have the first African-American president in the White House, but he, in fact, may be a descendant of the first official
on his
black
mother's
slave.
Side.
On his mother's side, not his African side. his mother's side, because
that's
children.
That's interesting. His children, white mother is a descendant.
Children of offspring are light skinned, and if you marry another white person, you become lighter and lighter, and voila, within a generation, you can pass.
My mother, in fact, had people in her family who moved north to like New York and were so light skinned that they could pass. And they just, the family never heard from them. They moved somewhere and they said, I'm white, and that was it. And they were, little do their descendants know today.
So
my mother, mother's sister.
When did the slave ship start? See, I think what you're saying is the very early Africans in the 1600s came, like the Scotch and the Irish, to be indentured servants, to be obligated for a few years, and then actually be free afterwards. When did the slavers start coming to the coast of Africa and start loading up their ships with hundreds of people in chains?
They were doing that in the 1500s and all the way through the 1600s, but they
the
were
Caribbean.
Going to Brazil.
You're right.
See, let's be clear about the numbers here. The first real true African slave in the Caribbean was 1526 by the Portuguese, who then started in Cuba and then went to Brazil. Now, starting in the 1500s, late 1500s, early 1600s, these Africans were brought in to work mostly in Brazil, Central America, and the Caribbean, mostly in sugarcane. But let's be clear, of the 20 million Africans stolen, 20% never made it here.
Right.
So only about 16 million made it to the New World.
They died in passage.
And they died in passage, either going from the interior to the coast or on the middle passage. But of the 16 million who made it here, only 500,000 made it to North America. 40% went to Brazil. 40% stayed in the Caribbean. 15% stayed in Central America. And only 5% comes to North America.
And one of the things that I learned while working for Colonial Williamsburg, at least by their historians, that the general lifespan of a slave working in the Caribbean, particularly in the sugar canes, was about 2 years. That was it. I mean, they just literally worked them to death, disposed of them, and brought more boatloads.
This
over.
Is why the 20 million number is not so crazy and extraordinary. In fact, they did work them to death. In fact, they worked to death earlier before the Africans came in, the Arawak Indians. So these islands of Jamaica and Haiti and Dominican Republic, they were occupied by Arawak Indians and also the Carib Indians. But as the British and the Portuguese and the Spanish worked
the
them
French,
to death,
right?
And the French, yeah. They worked them to death, and they kept bringing in new supply of inventory.
Yeah.
Wow. This is interesting stuff. Once again, my name is Garland Nixon, and I'm here with
Terry D. Kester
and
Mark Levine
and Dr. Bernard Demchuk, and we are the Raucous Caucus. We're right here at 1211 U Street, right next to Ben's Next Door. We're having a very, very interesting discussion, as you can hear. Stop by. There's still plenty of time. We'll be here until 8 o'clock. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C.
So,
Dr. Demchuk, so let's get
so
back
Garland,
to the legacy
Garland,
of slavery today.
Thank you. If I could try to frame this discussion in two parts. The first part, the first half of our session, we'll talk about the problem, and the problem is the legacy of slavery. The second half, I'd actually suggest that we talk about the solution to the problem.
Okay.
So let's talk about the problem right now. I would like to lay out four legacies of slavery. Number one would be wealth building and economic exploitation. Wealth building for white people, and that wealth is built in fact, the slave and his and her free labor.
But would you correct that? Just let me challenge that for a moment.
Sure.
You say on the wealth for white people, we're talking about the aristocracy.
The plantation owners.
No, yeah. Terry, that's a very good point. As a matter of fact, only 12% of white people own slaves.
Yeah.
That's a good point. The other 88% were poor whites.
Yeah, they were indentured servants or poor whites or tenant farmers.
Who were scrapping for the same
right.
scraps.
Even three-quarters yep. of the South didn't own slaves.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Most white people did not own slaves.
Yeah,
that's a
I
very
wanted,
good
I just
point.
Wanted to clarify that the aristocracy in this country, the 1%,
Thank
has
you.
Been here from the beginning and is still here.
Thank you.
Okay.
The second part of this legacy, we want to talk about the social destruction of the community. Not just the family, but the community, the dysfunction of the community today as we see in a ghetto, South Central, Chicago, Washington, D.C.'s area. And number three, I'd like to suggest a little bit discussion about the psychology well, the psychological impact of the legacy of slavery, and number four, the ongoing stereotypical image of African Americans as a legacy, the ongoing stereotypical image of the mammy, of the Jezebel, of the black buck, of the Uncle Tom, of the coon. It still exists today, and it still exists today in images, and it's an ongoing embarrassment. So, if I could, let's turn quickly to the economics. Obviously, there was enormous wealth made out of tobacco, made out of cotton, made out of corn, made out of wheat. All of these were the big crops that made very wealthy people very wealthy in this country. It was estimated in 1990 by economists, a conservative estimate, that of just the wages lost through slavery, just slavery, not Jim Crow. And by the way, may I define slavery as 246 years in American history. And may I define Jim Crow, and that's 1619 to 1865. That's 246 years. And may I define Jim Crow as 1865 to 1965. That's another 100 years of neo-slavery.
Well, you could also define it as what's happening now in Alabama, Texas, Missouri, et cetera.
And also imprisonment.
Take away people's rights to vote and return poll taxes, which they're doing right
Jim
now.
Jim Crow is back.
And also imprisonment and the free labor you get from from imprisoning people of color.
Yep.
And only today, Damon, only 47 years of legal equality since 1965. So that equals 346 years of white supremacy built on white wealth, offering more white wealth to more white supremacy.
Which makes that one point that some people always bring up, that by now they should have moved past it or whatever. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. We're not talking even a generation and a third at the most.
Yeah, generation
that
we've and a half.
Been,
yeah.
You know
not
what I do?
That,
yeah. You know what
and
I do,
just
Terry?
Absurd.
Moving past this, let me tell you what I do with my students. I bring my students out from – I teach a school without walls. I teach African-American history there. I bring my students out to the corner of 21st and Pennsylvania. I have on my coat and tie. I'm a white guy, in case the audience doesn't know. Demchuk, Polish. I stand out on the corner and I raise my hand, Garland, for a taxi. Taxi cabs, three taxi cabs are fighting over to pick me up. I then take one of my young students, junior in high school, African-American kid. I send him out to get a taxi cab. He stands out there for 10 or 15 minutes trying to get a cab. I say, come on, what's the matter with you? Why can't you get a cab? He's saying, they won't stop. Hello. This is year 2012.
Yep.
So this legacy continues even today. So let me go back to the wealth, if I may. So in 1990, economists had determined, general economists in a conservative way, had determined that $995 billion in wages, only in slavery, wages were stolen in slavery, just slavery. Now, if you add Jim Crow, sharecropping and neo-slavery for another 100 years, that totals $1.7 trillion in stolen wages just through economic
and
wealth.
If you add Bain Capital, who knows where it's going to go.
And if you add Bain Capital, precisely, or if you add any of the other great wealth. I took Garland a couple weeks ago on a tour of the area on the eastern shore of Maryland, Mark, where I did my dissertation on slavery on the eastern shore. And I showed Mark several of the manor houses that had that were huge slave plantations that continue to exist today.
Matter house?
Manor.
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 Oh, manor.
Manor house.
Manor.
Mansions.
Mansions.
In other words, a mansion. The term mansion comes from manor house. So these were English plantation manor homes on the eastern shore. They're still there today. They're still owned by the same families, and they are monstrous. And then we go to the small little African-American community, and they're still living in small little bungalows today. Of course, things are much different than they were just 100 years ago, just 50 years ago. But you can see the stark difference in wealth, Garland.
Yeah. And the people who are still living in opulence, incredible opulence, they're living off of that opulence because their families made this money, so much money off of slavery, that generation after generation after generation is born, and they still can't spend it all.
And it has to be made, and it's a point I think we've made before on the show, this country was not founded on the idea of freedom for you and me. It was not founded on that one little bit. It was founded on the idea of the aristocracy coming from England and a few other countries, but primarily from England, getting incredible land grants to preserve, to replicate the same kind of aristocratic power that existed in Europe at that time.
Doctor, can I ask you a question? I happen to live in Old Town Alexandria, and I want to confirm this is true, that the City Hall Plaza, that huge plaza in front of City Hall, was the second largest slave market in colonial America.
You're correct about that, and at some point, Garland, I hope we actually get to talk about Washington, D.C., because Washington, D.C. has a long history of slavery. By the way, Mark, thank you for raising that. Georgetown and Alexandria in the 1750s were not called Georgetown and Alexandria. They were called Port Tobacco. And they were,
yes,
and in 1791, when the federal government created the perfect diamond, being the District of Columbia,
right,
12 square miles, it included Alexandria and Arlington. Alexandria is named not after Alexandria of Egypt. It's named after John Alexander,
right,
the larger slave owner in Northern Virginia. Washington, Georgetown is not named after George Washington. It's named after King George.
King George,
that's right.
So
it's
in the 1791, in 1791, Washington, D.C. is carved out into a perfect diamond, and it's supposed to be the perfect jewel of this thing called democracy. But in fact, it was founded on slave labor in Alexandria and in Georgetown. And in fact, Washington, D.C. in the 1790s was carved out by slave labor. You know, running down the mall, running down the middle of the mall was a creek. It was called Tiber Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Tiber Creek was filled in with dirt to make the mall. How do they? How do you think they filled in the creek? They didn't fill it in with bulldozers. They filled it in with slave labor digging dirt and pushing it into the
wall. They also built the White House. They built the Capitol.
I recall, on the mall itself, there were two slave auction places, right?
Oh,
on
absolutely.
The
biggest auction spot in Washington, D.C. was where the archives sit today. Mm-hmm. It's at the corner of 7th and Pennsylvania. Ironic. Mm-hmm. And it was called the City Market, and it was the largest slave market in Washington, 7th and Pennsylvania. But let me go back a little bit to this legacy issue. The legacy issue of not just the $1.7 trillion in wages that were stolen, but the legacy during Jim Crow includes one: lower pay for the same work for African Americans, exclusion from good jobs, poor education, which disallows you to get a real job, and being excluded from a job just because of the blackness of your skin. So all of that continues during Jim Crow all the way up until the 1970s. And hey, may I say, it's probably happening again today.
It is. Yeah.
I'm not particularly discriminated against because of my color, but I think that, you know, there is discrimination, of course.
Voter suppression is one of the clearest examples of what's going on right now.
Right. And it's not just at African Americans. It's also the Latinos, which are definitely discriminated at in terms of job opportunity and wages.
Sure.
I just heard a story where you probably know this, that the janitors in Houston are going on strike, thank heavens. Not that they're organized enough to have a real union or anything, but they are going on strike. And one of the reasons is they are getting paid about $12,000 a year to clean in the Exxon Tower, the J.P. Morgan Tower, $12,000. That's slavery.
Allow me then to go on to the other 2 points. I think it's pretty obvious, 3 points. It's pretty obvious the economic impact is pretty severe. There's the social cost as well. Social cost revolves around this thing called poverty. If you can't get a certain job, if you're passed over, if you can't get the same wages, if you're confined in a ghetto, as it were, for 346 years, you in fact have a social issue problem. And that social issue revolves around poverty. And poverty produces what? It produces poor housing, it produces poor education, poor health, and it produces all the things. Particularly, it produces anger, it produces crime, it produces imprisonization, and it produces a dysfunctional community.
A dysfunctional family, because they're trying to survive.
The third legacy that I would like to suggest would be simply housing discrimination. And this is very severe. There's a reason that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was signed. The 1964 Civil Rights Act is different than the 65. 64 is housing accommodations. 65 is voter registration. Housing discrimination was very severe for between 1930 and 1960, where African Americans are redlined out of suburban America. So as suburban America takes off, particularly after World War II, African Americans cannot move into suburbia, and where are they confined? They're confined into ghettos and are confined into poor housing, which is supported, by the way, by the federal government in something called the Housing Finance Agency. So this was official discrimination by the federal government all the way up until the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And then the last legacy, if I may, is the stereotypical image of African Americans. And today it's being played out on black and black crime. Oh, black people are killing black people. All black people, just all the crime in America is black. That is not true. As a matter of fact, when you go into white communities, white people are killing white people just as much as black people are killing black people if they're poor. It's about poorness,
it's about poverty, it's about money,
yes, it's about not having a job, it's not about skin color. So what we get out of this legacy is the ongoing stereotypical image of black people being different, being the other, being shiftless or being lazy or being violent or being Jezebels or mammies or bucks or being Uncle Tom.
I want to ask you a question.
And last but not least, this image just continues, Terry, to bother us today.
You mentioned, Doctor, that in the very parts about it, the social and psychological impact as well that we touched on very briefly. And it seems to me, you know, in studying human condition, there is nothing that could possibly, and this is a question to you if I'm correct in this assumption, there is nothing that could be more destructive to any race or group of people than, frankly, enslaving men. And I don't mean to try to create an inequality or there anything else, but given that the social responsibility of fatherhood, et cetera, which is supposed to exist, you know, there's nothing more demeaning to take somebody and show them and convince them that they are absolutely powerless. They are absolutely powerless to defend their family. They're absolutely powerless to defend their children or their loved ones. They are just stripped of anything that we, frankly, do take as a part of the masculinity of being able to protect and defend our homes. And we literally can't, you can't do that if you're enslaved and if they just sell your family off whenever they want to.
Let me comment on that. That's a very important point, because when I grew up, the stories that I heard from my father about African-American men, that he grew up with, and facing, you know, overwhelming odds and things, they couldn't get a job, they couldn't have, they couldn't support their family very well. The way it crushed their spirit psychologically. Some of them turned to alcohol. Some of them just threw their hands up. It was different for the African American man, because the man was looked to support his family and to provide for his family. But because of the social issues, he was completely denied the opportunity to do that in the fashion that he felt would bring respect to him as a provider for
totally
the household.
Totally demoralizing.
We got to go to break very soon, right, Dan? No, I just want to
be very but not quite yet.
And Garland, if I may, this is the psychological trauma of the legacy of slavery, when men cannot feel as if they're men, and when women are brutalized psychologically, seeing their man being emasculated as
such.
It's
a vicious, horrible cycle.
Right, and then you get the loop, the feedback loop with the young men looking up to the father and seeing the things that happen to him. So you create a vicious loop. But by the way, we'll be back in a minute. We're going to go to break. You're listening to Raucous Caucus, WPFW 89.3 FM. We'll be back in a minute.
WPFW 89.3 FM invites you to join us on Thursday, August 2nd through Monday, August 6th and participate in our summer mini drive. We're counting on listeners like you to help us reach our goal. Pledge early and often. Visit us online at WPFW.org and donate now. And as always, thanks.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening and welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. My name's Garland Nixon and I'm right here with
Terry D. Kester.
And what's the D for, Terry?
Doctor of Discernment.
Doctor of Discernment.
It changes every week.
Okay. This
what do you mean every week? It changes yearly. Come on.
We've got about 6 months.
Yeah, so. Right. Come on. Pay attention.
I thought it was the Doctor of Sagacity.
Doctor of Sagacity is still there. Yeah, he's still working hard.
You've
got
I thought it was Dr. Demento.
And I'm here with
Mark Levine.
And with our special guest, Dr. Bernard Demchuk. He is a professor, a historian specializing in African-American history. Professor at GW. And we're talking about the legacy of slavery. And it's a very interesting show. We're right here at Ben's Next Door. If you got time to stop by, we'll be here until 8. We're finding a lot of very interesting information and
frightening
facts.
And interesting.
I wanted to ask you, Doctor, you talked about culture. And I find culture very interesting because the official purveyors of culture today are not allowed to be as racist, certainly as they were. I mean, there was certainly a time in the 50s, 60s, you could think of, you know, Little Black Sambo in restaurants or comic books or in the media or
cartoons,
situation comedies, everything was very, very racist. And then there comes this period where now I really want to address the issue of culture because I don't know that there's a white or black person in America, certainly not in an area that's racially mixed, that hasn't heard racism. Everyone hears it. You hear it all the time. But it's more person to person than coming from the media. Or do you think it's more of a subtext? It's just not that the media is still racist in a subtextual way rather than in an open way.
Well, this is a good question and a complicated question. I think it's both, Mark. And I think that it's a much more subtle, visceral racism that all white people, including myself, learned very early on, that when we watch Channel 5 news in the evening, we see yet another black man, black youth, being arrested and hauled off to jail for some kind of crime. When we are born and raised,
do you think we see black youth more than white youth? Are there studies that show that Channel 5 News, I mean, you pointed out poor white people kill at the same rates as poor black people. Do you think Channel 5 News covers poor black
poor
people?
White, poor people.
No,
more than
no,
poor white people.
They do not, and particularly not in this area. So in this area, it is a much different kind of culture because of the different demographics, particularly in Washington, D.C. But you're raising a very subtle point. I think most white people have been born and raised in a white supremacist society, and we feel as if we have certain privileges what goes with our whiteness, and we don't even know many times when we're being racist and discriminatory. So I think it's we don't see the Sambo images anymore, but we still do see the images of black men being hauled off to jail consistently.
Right, and look at these things are still bubbling below the surface because every so often we see something come out in the media where some Tea Party member or something has sent an email of the president dressed like a monkey or with the N-word or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But I think...
Or do we see a neighborhood watchman down in Florida
who sees a suspicious person? But let me tell you why the question that you asked was very important, Mark. Extremely important. Because it brings to the surface the issue. And here's the issue. Things having the effect of racism without the intention of racism.
Yeah.
So what happens is, you have people who will do things, African-American people, who learn the same things in the society. I was a police officer. I saw instances, African-American police officers, they watch the same movies, they see the same, shows and news, where you would see people in our society who did not have the intent to be racist or the intent for their acts to be racist, but the effect was in fact racism because of what they thought and what they believed and because the foundation of what was driving them to act.
Mark, let me go back to 1954 with Brown versus Board. When Brown versus Board was successful in overturning Plessy versus Ferguson of 1896, which was separate but equal, Brown versus Board said that the educational system needed to be integrated. Segregation needed to be ended. The most powerful argument in the courtroom was not, in fact, the moral or the legal argument. The most powerful argument in the courtroom was the doll argument. The child's dolls. Which doll did you prefer, young black girl? Did you prefer the white doll or do you prefer the black doll? All the children preferred the white doll. If you do the same experiment today in the inner city, I guarantee you young black girls will choose the white doll.
Still.
The image today, yeah. Still, God bless her, I love her, still today it's the image of a Beyonce. It's the image of a long-haired, beautiful, light blonde person being the most important image today. That is, in fact, a reality on the front of almost all of the model magazines today.
I'd just be curious, have there been studies to update the famous doll experiment?
Studies are happening now as we speak, as a matter of fact.
But there's no question that the basic thing that we see, and this is something that, frankly, as a white myself, I have only learned, well, frankly, to be perfectly honest, I learned it while working with WPFW. I mean, it's really where I became aware of it, is the inherent idea of white supremacy that you were talking about. It is something that permeates our society at every single level, mostly, for the most part, unconsciously. And it leads to the kind of racism that you were talking about that's in some ways just, in some ways even more insidious because we don't recognize it as a result of this inherent belief in white supremacism.
Gentlemen, here's a picture that I'm holding up for you, and I'll describe it to our listening audience. Here's a picture of a study done in 2003. They interviewed 2,084 people with different colored skin tones from 1 to 10, 1 being the lightest, 10 being the darkest. And of these people, they investigated their economic prowess in America. And this particular study shows very conclusively that the lighter your skin, the higher your wage. The darker your skin, the lower your wage. Whether or not that's a fact of poverty or education or history or whatever, it doesn't matter. The fact is today, this is the results.
When we go, if you go back to slavery, the lighter skinned slaves were allowed to be in the house, were given the privileges,
right,
were given the better jobs, were given a lot more privileges. In fact, let me make a point from right here in D.C. There was an area down in Annapolis. Hope I'm not upsetting anybody, but this is the truth. There's an area down in Annapolis called Highland Beach. And it's an incorporated town. And what I found out some years ago was it was like one of the first black incorporated towns in America or something like that. But at any rate, what it was around the early 1900s, African Americans who had a lot of money in the D.C. area who had beach houses and they could go down there. And I would go down there for various reasons and their descendants were there. And you know what I found? Most of them looked, you couldn't tell whether they were white or black.
People forget that Plessy v. Ferguson, that the man that wanted to enter the train, and they called him this, it's a weird term, they called him an octoroon. That's right there in 1896, meaning that he's
one-eighth
African and seven-eighths white, and he wanted to enter the white train, and they said he could not. Plessy v. Ferguson was not about a very dark-skinned person trying to enter a train, but white people not being able to tell very carefully that this guy was white or black and but, wanting that.
So they weren't sure whether or not to discriminate him against
him.
Very good, Mark. To be more specific, Homer Plessy was passing for white. He was in a white car.
Right.
One of the passengers in the white car knew him from New Orleans and told the conductor, "That guy is actually colored."
Right.
It's the term of the choice, of course, at the time. "That guy's colored. He's not white." And the conductor asked him, he says, "Mister, are you white or are you colored?" He says, "I am colored." He says, you need to get off the train." He gets
colored
off the train.
Colored because one of his great-grandparents was African.
He gets off the train at the next stop, and then he proceeds to sue, and, of course, he loses the lawsuit.
Is this gradation that you're talking about, and this little chart that you showed us we're talking about, is this gradation the same throughout all racial groups? I mean, in the preference towards a lighter skin?
I think it's part of this legacy that we're talking about slavery, about the field slave, about the house slave.
But I mean, is it true of Asians?
Yes, it is.
I know, for example, in Mexico, in Mexican culture,
in
the people
culture
who are whiter, I don't know. I can't speak broadly for Hispanic because I don't have that knowledge. But I do know that in the country of Mexico, people who are whiter and presumed to be more of Spanish heritage are definitely favored over people who are mestizo or considered to be more of the Native American.
Well, all you have to do is look in South Florida. In South Florida, when you look at the Cubans that are in South Florida that are all Republicans,
you look at
a certain person who is maybe considered to run for vice president, he doesn't look like the Cubans.
No,
he looks like Ricky Ricardo.
He
doesn't look like the other Cubans.
And most of the presidents of Mexico have been pretty white looking.
And if I may interject here, Mark, this actually is another part of the legacy of slavery, and that is we don't talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. We really don't. You know, we don't teach. You know, we do not teach African American history in D.C. public schools.
You're kidding.
Let me repeat that. We do not teach African American history in the D.C. public schools. I teach it at School Without Walls. There is a course at Banneker, and there is another course, I think, at McKinley. But it's up to really the individual principal. There is no curriculum in D.C. public schools. I know that because my students and I testified on January 25th this year. We testified in front of the school board asking them to please create a curriculum of African American history in the public schools. They do not teach that. And if they did teach it, they have to teach 246 years of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, and they have to teach white supremacy. We don't talk about it. We don't teach it. And consequently, we're constantly coming over the same.
I took a couple courses in African American history in college. But African American history is American history.
Thank you. It is.
You can't understand American history. You can't understand the Civil War.
Our culture.
You can't understand the Revolution. You can't understand the whole history of American slavery in the South and colonization.
Even culture, music.
Civil rights, music, jazz. Everything. You can't understand American history without understanding African American history. It makes no sense.
American culture is loved and admired all over the world. All over the world. And guess what? American culture is infused by an African culture into the European culture that has created this great thing in America called jazz and blues and rock and roll and religion and sports and dance and everything else and cuisine. We all love the cuisine of America, and it is the drum is the most important ingredient of African culture that is there. Every piece of modern music today, being the last 130 years, comes from the drum, brought to us directly from Africa.
And wasn't that true of Native Americans as well, or not?
Yes, indeed.
I would argue that Native American culture, unfortunately, I was referring to
the drum.
Because of genocide. Vast majority of them were wiped out.
I just was referring to the percussion.
If I may go back to this other subtle question that Mark raised. Mark, there's another iconic picture that occurred right after Katrina on August 30th, 2005. There's an iconic picture was on Associated Press website.
Wow.
The Associated Press had a picture.
Oh, this is extreme. You got to see this.
Had a picture of a young black man wading chest deep through water right after Katrina, and the young black man, and the article says he has looted food from a local store.
There's two captions.
Right behind him, same picture, same caption, two white people in the same water from the same store found food rather than looted food. So the difference in words.
By the same day?
The same day,
same
the
picture.
Same time, the
Do
same
we
picture,
know who
the
wrote
same
the
photographer.
Captions?
The black guy is looting food. The white people are finding food.
Both of these are by the Associated Press. Am I reading this correctly?
Here's what's important about that, Mark.
That person should be fired,
and I'll tell you why. I would say that person shouldn't be fired, and let me tell you why. Because if we say that person should be fired, then we're saying that individual saw things that way and should be fired. I would argue, and like I always say, there are many times you have the effect of racism without the intent.
Oh, I don't
I
care whether that person
that
had the intent or not.
There are a whole lot of other people in this country who would see the same thing, and because of what the stereotypes they see, would say the same thing. What we're looking at here is something that reflects one of the diseases, the racial diseases, emotional diseases, emotional problems of America.
Garland, I don't disagree with you that the person probably didn't do it intentionally, but we're moving on, I guess, segueing from problems to solutions. And it seems to me that one of the ways to help get the legacy of slavery better, to help make things better, is to say to anyone that takes an image of white people and black people both wading through water with food that they got from a store and says the black guy's looting and the white people have found food and water – by firing them and by setting that standard in the newsroom,
by firing who?
whoever wrote that caption, I want fired.
Let's get another angle. What do you think about it, Terry?
Well, that's the key. I think you're being a little reasonable. I agree more with Mark because you're talking about something that is insidious. I agree with Garland. I'm sorry. I never agree with Mark.
I was about to say you agree with Mark. I'm crushed.
I apologize.
You never do agree with me.
I haven't agreed with Mark in years.
You wouldn't fire the person who wrote that caption?
No, because I would fire the whole darn staff or call them because what you're talking about is an editorial process.
You're talking about a publisher.
The editor, everybody.
You're talking about
a
whole insidious organization that didn't even see the problem.
I would fire
That's
every person
point.
Who saw that caption before it was published.
But
then you'd have to fire about half the Washington Post.
I'd be willing to do that.
Keep in mind.
Every other paper I can think of.
Keep in mind, this is just one small example of many things that happened around Katrina from letting even the people to die in the first place and saying, we can't get in there because it's too dangerous. And meanwhile, people like Geraldo Rivera are, walking around the streets, and people are saying, help us. Right. And other people are saying, we can't get in because it's too dangerous.
And not to mention Blackwater, not to ever forget Blackwater being right there, wandering around too with no problem. Anyway, we got some solutions here. We've got some problems.
We do have problems, and I think that all of these incidences that we're raising tonight are the legacies of slavery. And may I go back and suggest solution number one to these problems? Number one, we need to teach American history as the true history of America, not from the great dead white men's perspective. I have no disrespect for the great dead white men. They were great. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt. They were great men. They did great things. They moved our country forward. But to teach American history from an Afrocentric perspective, to teach American history from also an African American perspective, allows us to learn and understand the true history.
I want to see a Native American perspective.
Absolutely,
I mean, they're living here for hundreds of years.
You've got to understand something that I learned, and Bernard and I were talking about it before. When I worked for Colonial Williamsburg, what I found out very quickly is that history is a commodity in this country, and that has to be understood. It's a commodity, and what sells is what's going to be the history. And the clearest example of that is the good old school boards of good old Texas, which is one of the largest, of course, school systems in the country. They do a tremendous buying of textbooks and everything else. And what they decide very often to buy as a textbook is what the rest of the country often falls in step with, because the publisher is selling to Texas millions of copies. That's where the market is. History in this country does not have to do with fact or reality or analysis. It has to do with what sells. And as long as we don't understand that and break that cycle, we're not going to make any progress. That's the end of that. Show's over. Might as well go home.
A second suggestion to solutions is to continue. And I live in Washington, D.C. I've been here for 40 years now. And I do appreciate places like U Street and H Street and Anacostia really trying to bring out and not just preserve but celebrate African American history.
What a perfect place to do that, Ben's
right next
to Ben's Chili Bowl, which is an institution in itself.
Thank you, Mark. Ben's Chili Bowl and Howard Theater and the Martin Luther King Monument and the new African American History Museum. What a great place. Howard University. What a great place in Washington, D.C. Other cities have these kind of iconic places as well. What a great place to not only preserve but celebrate African American history. You celebrate it through sports. You celebrate it through gospel. You celebrate it through jazz, through the blues. You celebrate it through eating cornbread and eating greens and eating chitlins. I like chitlins. I actually eat chitlins. Most people don't eat chitlins. I do. And I think we need to promote this history, which is American history and which is American culture. So number two, we need to continue not only to preserve but to celebrate Black history.
Now, here's a let me throw a question out. The big a huge issue that gets people all freaked out. You know, a few years ago, there was approximately $20,000 given to each of the Japanese Americans who were left over from the internment camps of
World War II.
From FDR.
World War II.
FDR's internment camps of WW2. And the issue of reparations, who our favorite guy, John Conyers, has brought up for many, many years. That it's thrown out there. We hear a lot of different things about it. I want to hear your perspective on the issue of reparations.
That was going to be my third. Thank you for preempting me, Garland. That was going to be my third solution, and that is having a serious discussion in this country on reparations. We have not had a serious discussion. The first discussion on reparations really, quite frankly, goes back to the 1830s and 40s. Even Frederick Douglass talked about this term called black power. Black power was the power of the black man and woman who created the wealth. And he talked about being compensated for that. By the way, in the compensation, the D.C. Emancipation Compensation Act of 1862, on April 16th, 1862, when the African Americans were freed from slavery in D.C., 9 months before the emancipation, they were freed. Their master was given $300 per slave. So 3,100 individuals were freed, and their master was given $300
for their slave. And I'll take it that the individuals were not given anything.
The individuals were given nothing.
How is this different from today?
So,
are you kidding? Foreclosures, banks is exactly the same.
Reparations has a long, long history in America, and it goes back.
Well, that's reparations to the master, not.
Right, yeah,
no,
that's
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Always.
The rich guy gets it.
Every time.
I'm saying that a little bit sardonically, Mark. And so,
clearly.
So in 1968, the Republic of New Africa actually had a formula for reparations starting in 68. 1969, actually. But Jim Foreman, the head of SNCC during the time, he wrote the Black Manifesto. He called for $5 billion for reparations. The Republic of New Africa called for $40 billion. And John Conyers, in the year 2000, introduced a reparation, legislation in Congress. Let me read to you, Garland, if I may, the definition of crimes against humanity that leads to the legal international law situation of reparations. This is where you get reparations from the international law of crimes against humanity. Quote, you deserve reparations as a people if you have experienced murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other humane acts committed against your civilization. Quote, unquote. So Jewish people were very fortunate in getting reparations and demanding it, rightfully so, from the Germans and from the Austrians. The state of Israel received reparations. The Jewish people received reparations. Garland mentioned that the Japanese people received reparations, and the Native Americans in the United States have received reparations. I'll just use the state of Alaska as an example. In Alaska, they were given $4 billion, the Native Americans in Alaska, $4 billion plus 4.4 million acres. So reparations is not some pie in the sky, and we're not talking here about giving every black man and woman and children a check for $50,000. We're not talking about that.
Or 40 acres and a mule.
Or 40, well, 40 acres and a mule was a real deal in 1865 by General Howard, the guy who founded Howard University, a white general. His name was Oliver Otis Howard. He was in South Carolina, and he wrote back to Lincoln and said, I have a solution to this problem of what are we going to do with these tens of thousands of newly emancipated people? What are we going to do? He said, give them 40 acres and a mule because that with the land and with a mule, they can fend for themselves. So this is not a foreign idea in America.
Well, I'm curious, whatever happened to 40 acres and a mule?
40 acres and a mule went to the wayside by a guy by the name of John Wilkes Booth, who blew the brains out
so
of
Lincoln
Abraham
was willing,
Lincoln.
Lincoln was willing to support
Oliver Howard. When Lincoln died and his successor was Andrew Johnson, who was a slaver himself, the vice president, he nixed the idea. And what did General Howard do? He gave up the position of being the Freedmen Bureau's director, and he started this little school up at his mansion. It's still there today. You've seen it up on the hill of Howard. That was his house. He opened up a little school for newly
emancipated. The founder of Howard University was the guy who had the idea of 40 acres and a mule.
Let me ask, Bernard.
I told you this was going to be a great show.
Fascinating.
Terry.
Is that a realistic number? The only reason I ask it again is, you know, from working for Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, is that the tenant farmer with 40 acres basically could not make it, particularly if it wasn't good land. So I wonder often if it isn't just almost a little bit of a side issue. I mean,
depends on the acres.
No, yeah, acres. 40 acres.
Depends on where it is.
No. These were very highly productive lands in South Carolina and Georgia. These are the Sea Islands. This was rice.
Right.
This wasn't cotton.
They could make
this was rice, and they were producing a lot of wealth on those plantations until the Civil War came, and you know, God bless Lincoln. God bless Lincoln. He's one of those great dead white men that I greatly respect. But the Emancipation Proclamation did not free anybody.
Right.
What freed
all the people who were not under Union control.
What freed people
is no
one. When the Union Army marched on a plantation at gunpoint and said,
right.
Master, you is no longer in charge.
Right.
These people are in charge. That's what
and some people, as we know from our celebration a couple months ago, were not freed until Juneteenth.
Texas. Yeah.
And keep in mind the other thing about the 40 acres and a mule. You had people who knew how to farm.
That's right.
That's what they did.
They knew
what the plant,
right.
how to
farm. You didn't have to teach them how.
They were the best.
No, no.
The reality was the owners of the plantations didn't know how to farm.
They did
had
nothing.
These people
didn't even live there.
Garland would have been a good
solution. They didn't even live there. They lived in Philadelphia. They didn't even live on the plantation. The black people ran the entire plantation from the books, literally from the books, to the health care, to the food, to the babies, to the building of the house. They ran everything. They knew what to do.
Now, just out of curiosity, do you actually know any numbers of what kind of money these people made? Is there any numbers of what kind of money?
Yes, that stuff is broken down. I don't have it right here in front of me. That stuff is broken down, but it comes out to $995 billion by 1865 in stolen wages.
Is that in 1865 dollars?
1865? No, that's
in today's
dollars. That's today's dollars.
Okay,
but let me also remind us that Spike Lee's film production company is called
40 acres and a mule.
So this stuff is real, and so what we're talking about is perhaps a social black bank.
Let me suggest to
a
you
social
today.
Black bank,
well, I want to hear this. What is
a social black bank? Yeah. It would not be, and it would go for 40 years. The idea here is a social black bank that would be established for 40 years. 40 years being 1 year for every 10 years of slavery. 400 years of slavery, 40 years of a social black bank. Social black bank might have in it $1.5 trillion. It might have in it $900 billion. I don't know what it is. What did they bail out the banks with? They bailed out the banks with $800 billion. $800 billion. And we're still struggling with foreclosures. The bankers aren't being foreclosed.
Of course not.
The bankers are doing quite fine. Thank you very much, Daniel. But if you put $1 trillion into a social black bank and you used it for four reasons. Number one, guaranteeing every African-American child has the basic needs that he or she needs. Food, housing, clothing, shelter, health care. Number two, funds for capital startup of black businesses. Number three, home ownership support in buying homes for African-Americans. And number five, invest in the inner city public schools.
I'm going to give you another one.
You would transform the entire
city. Let me tell you what I transform.
America, not just black America.
Yeah, no.
You transform America.
Yeah. And part of that transformation would simply be the American public having to recognize the problem that exists and has always existed, which the American public in general just continues to avoid.
And American, I'll say this, and America talks about, African Americans in poverty as though it's not part of America. The reality is this, it's part of the poverty
history.
In America.
Right.
We need to work to eliminate poverty. There's a significant number of African Americans that are living in poverty, it would address the.
Let me give you, I think, a reparation solution that I think could actually pass Congress and I think would do the job really of.
They could get through the House.
Not this current Congress,
yeah,
but a future Congress.
Okay.
And it actually comes off the idea of 40 acres and a mule. 150 years ago, the best way for a newly freed slave to succeed was 40 acres and a mule. Today, we know in 2012, the best way for anyone to succeed is education. That is how Barack Obama and Bill Clinton grew up in poverty and had great education. I think reparations should provide a free education to every African American. They don't have to pay back those loans. That's the best solution.
Well, we got to go. My name's Garland Nixon here with
Terry D. Kester
and
Mark Levine
and Dr. Bernard Dumchuk.
Dumchuk.
We've had a great show. Next Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m., we'll be
studio.
In the studio. You can call in. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM.
Stay tuned
Washington,
for Brother
DC.
On the Jazz Collectors.
Ah! at 89.3 FM. This is member-supported WPFW Washington. Thank you.